the scene vanished, leaving the suzerain to contemplate this news. It was too late, of course, to recall the invitations and cancel the ceremony. Even the other suzerains recognized this. The shunt must be completed, and they must prepare to receive honored guests. To do otherwise might damage the Gubru cause irrevocably. The suzerain danced a dance of anger and frustration. It muttered short, sharp imprecations. "Curse the devil, trickster Timbrimmy!" In retrospect, the very idea of garthlings, native pre-sentience that survived the holocaust of the Burrali, was absurd, and yet the trail of false evidence had been so startlingly plausible, so striking in its implied opportunity. The suzerain of propriety had begun this expedition in a lead position. Its place in the eventual molt had seemed assured after the untimely demise of the first suzerain of cost and caution. But all that changed when no garthlings were found, when it became clear just how thoroughly propriety had been tricked. Failure to find evidence of human misuse of Garth or their clients meant that the suzerain still had not yet set foot upon the soil of this planet. That, in turn, had retarded the development of completion hormones. All of these factors were setbacks, throwing the molt into serious doubt. Then, insurrection among the neo-chimpanzees helped bring the military to the fore. Now the suzerain of Beam and Talon was rapidly growing preeminent, unstoppable. The coming molt filled the suzerain of propriety with foreboding. Such events were supposed to be triumphant, transcendent, even for the losers. Moltings were times of renewal and sexual fulfillment for the race. They were also supposed to represent crystallization of policy, consensus on correct action. This time, however, there was little or no consensus. Something was very wrong about this molting. The only thing all three suzerains were in agreement about was that the hyperspace shunt must be used for some sort of uplift ceremony. To do otherwise would be suicidal at this point. But beyond that, they parted company. Their incessant arguing had begun affecting the entire expedition. The more religious Talon soldiers had taken to bickering with their comrades. Bureaucrats who were retired soldiers sided with their former comrades over logistical expenditures, or turned sullen when their chief overruled them. Even among the priesthood, there were frequent arguments where there should already be unanimity. The priest had just recently discovered what factionalism could do. The divisiveness had gone all the way to the point of betrayal. Why else had one of its two race-leader chimpanzees been stolen? Now the suzerain of cost and caution was insisting on a role in choosing the new male. No doubt the bureaucrat was responsible for the escape of the Fibbon Bulger chimp in the first place. Such a promising creature it had been. By now, it no doubt had been converted to vapor and ashes. There would be no way to pin this on either of the rival suzerains, of course. A Kwaku servitor approached and knelt, proffering a data cube in its beak. Given assent, it popped the record into a player unit. The room dimmed, and the suzerain of propriety watched a camera's eye view of driving rain and darkness. It shivered involuntarily, disliking the ugly, dank dinginess of a wolfling town. The view panned over a muddy patch in a dark alley, a broken shack made of wire and wood, where Terran birds had been kept as pets, a pile of soggy clothing beside a padlocked factory, footprints leading to a churned-up field of mud beside a bent and battered fence, more footprints leading off into the dim wilderness. The implications were apparent to the suzerain before the investigator's report reached its conclusion. The male neo-chimpanzee had perceived the trap set for it. It appeared to have made good its escape. The suzerain danced upon its perch a series of mincing steps of ancient lineage.
The harm, damage, setback to our program is severe, but it is not, may not be irreparable.
At a gesture, its Kwaku followers hurried forward. The suzerain's first command was straightforward.
We must increase, improve, enhance our commitment, our incentives. Inform the female that we agree, accept, acquiesce to her request. She may go to the library.
The servitor bowed, and the other Kwaku crooned. Zoon. Chapter 69. Government in Exile. The hollow tank cleared as the interstellar message ran to its end. When the lights came on, the council members looked at each other in puzzlement.
What does it mean? Colonel Maven asked.
I'm not sure, said Commander Kiley, but it's clear the Gubru are up to something.
Refuge Administrator Mu Chen drummed her fingers on the table.
They appeared to be officials from the Uplift Institute. It seems to mean the invaders are planning some sort of uplift ceremony and have invited witnesses.
That much is obvious, Megan thought.
Do you think this has anything to do with that mysterious construction south of Port Helena?
She asked. The site had been a topic of much discussion lately. Colonel Maven nodded.
I had been reluctant to admit the possibility before, but now I'd have to say so.
The Chim member spoke.
Why would they want to hold an uplift ceremony for the Kwaku here on Garth? It doesn't make sense.
Would that improve their claim on our leasehold?
I doubt it, Megan said. Maybe it isn't for the Kwaku at all.
But then for who? Megan shrugged. Kylie commented.
The Uplift Institute officials appear to be in the dark as well.
There was a long silence. Then Kylie broke it again.
How significant do you think it is that the spokesman was human?
Megan smiled.
Obviously, it was meant as a dig at the Gubru. That man might have been no more than a junior clerk trainee at the local Uplift Institute branch. Putting him out in front of Pila and Zatang and Serentini means Earth isn't finished yet, and certain powers want to point that out to the Gubru.
Pila. They're tough customers, and members of the Sorrow clan. Having a human spokesman might be an insult to the Gubru, but it's no guarantee Earth is okay.
Megan understood what Kylie meant.
If the Sorrow now dominated Earth space, there were rough times ahead. Again another long silence. Then Colonel Maven spoke.
They mentioned a hyperspace shunt. Those were expensive. The Gubru must set great store by this ceremony thing.
Indeed,
Megan thought, knowing that a motion had been put before the council, and this time she realized that it would be hard to justify holding to Uther Calding's advice.
You are suggesting a target, Colonel?
I sure am, Madam Coordinator.
Megan sat up and met her eyes.
I think this is the opportunity we've been waiting for.
There were nods of agreement up and down the table.
They are voting out of boredom and frustration and sheer cabin fever,
Megan knew.
And yet, is this not a golden chance to be seized or lost forever? We cannot attack once the emissaries from the Uplift Institute have arrived,
she emphasized, and saw that everybody understood how important that was.
However, I agree that there may be a window of opportunity during which a strike could be made.
Consensus was obvious. In a corner of her mind, Megan felt there really ought to be more discussion, but she, too, was near filled to bursting with impatience.
We shall cut new orders to Major Prathachulthorn, then. He shall receive carte blanche. subject only to the condition that any attack be completed by November 1st. Is it agreed?
A simple raising of hands. Commander Kiley hesitated, then joined in to make it unanimous.
We are committed, Megan thought.
And she wondered if hell reserved a special place for mothers who send their own sons into battle. Chapter 70 Robert.
She didn't have to go away, did she? I mean, she herself said it was all right.
Robert rubbed his stubbled chin. He thought about taking a shower and shaving. Major Prathachulthorn would be calling a meeting sometime after it reached full light, and the commander liked to see his officers well-groomed.
What I really should be doing is sleeping,
Robert knew. They had just finished a whole series of night exercises. It would be wise to catch up on his rest. And yet, after a couple of hours of fitful slumber, he had found himself too nervous, too full of restless energy to stay in bed any longer. He had risen and gone to his small desk, setting up the data well so its light would not disturb the chamber's other occupant. For some time he read through Major Prathachulthorn's detailed order of battle. It was ingenious, professional. The various options appeared to offer a number of efficient ways to use limited forces to strike the enemy, and strike him hard. All that remained was choosing the right target. There were several choices available, any of which ought to do. Still, something about the entire edifice struck Robert as wrong. The document did not increase his confidence as he had hoped it would. In the space over his head, Robert almost imagined something taking form, something faintly akin to the dark clouds that had shrouded the mountains in storms so recently, a symbolic manifestation of his unease. Across the little chamber, a form moved under the blankets. One slender arm lay exposed, and a smooth length of calf and thigh. Robert concentrated and erased the non-thing that he had been forming with his simple aura power. It had begun affecting Lydia's dreams, and it wouldn't be fair to inflict his own turmoil upon her. For all of their recent physical intimacy, they were still in many ways strangers. Robert reminded himself that there were some positive aspects to the last few days. The battle plan, for instance, showed that Prathachulthorn was at last taking some of his ideas seriously, and spending time with Lydia had brought more than physical pleasure. Robert had not realized how much he missed the simple touch of his own kind. Humans might be able to withstand isolation better than chimps, who could fall into deep depression if they lacked a grooming partner for very long. But Mel and Fem humans, too, have their ape-like needs. Still, Robert's thoughts kept drifting. Even during his most passionate moments with Lydia, he kept thinking of somebody else. Did she really have to leave? Logically, there was no reason to have to go to Mount Fosse. The gorillas were already well cared for. Of course, the gorillas might have been just an excuse. An excuse to escape the disapproving aura of Major Prathachulthorn, an excuse to avoid the sparking discharges from human passion. Athaclena might be correct that there was nothing wrong with Robert seeking his own kind, but logic was not everything. She had feelings, too. Young and alone, she could be hurt even by what she knew to be right.
Damn,
Robert muttered. Prathachulthorn's words and graphs were a blur.
Damn, I miss her.
There was a commotion outside, beyond the flap of cloth that sectioned off this chamber from the rest of the caves. Robert looked at his watch. It was still only 4 a.m. He stood up and gathered his trousers. Any unplanned excitement at this hour was likely to be bad news. Just because the enemy had been quiet for a month did not mean it had to stay that way. Perhaps the Gubru had gotten wind of their plans and were striking preemptively. There was the slap of unshod feet upon stone.
"Captain Honeygle?"
a voice said from just beyond the cloth. Robert strode over and pulled it aside. A winded Chim messenger breathed heavily.
"What's happening?" Robert asked.
Sir, you better come quick."
"All right, let me get my weapons."
The Chim shook her head.
"It's not fighting, sir. It's some Chims just arrived from Port Helena."
Robert frowned. New recruits from town had been arriving in small groups all along. What was all the excitement about this time? He heard Lydia stir as the talking disturbed her sleep.
"Fine," he told the Chimmy. "We'll interview them a little later." She interrupted.
"Sir, it's Fibbin. Fibbin Bolger, sir. He's come back."
Robert blinked.
"What?"
There was movement behind him.
"Rob?"
a feminine voice spoke.
"What is—"
Robert whooped. His shout reverberated in the closed spaces. He hugged and kissed the surprised Chimmy, then caught up Lydia and tossed her lightly into the air.
"What?"
she started to ask, then stopped, for she found herself addressing only the empty space where he had been. Actually, there was little need to hurry. Fibbin and his escorts were still some distance away. By the time their horses could be seen, puffing up the trail from the north, Lydia had dressed and joined Robert up on the escarpment. There, dawn's gray light was just driving out the last wan stars.
"Everybody's up,"
Lydia commented.
"They even roused the major. Chims are dashing all over the place, jabbering in excitement. This must be some Chin we're waiting for."
"Fibbin?"
Robert laughed. He blew into his hands.
"Yeah, you might say old Fibbin's unusual."
"I gathered as much."
She shaded her eyes against the glow to the east and watched the mounted party pass a switchback climbing the narrow trail.
"Is he the one in the bandages?"
"Hm?" Robert squinted. Lydia's eyesight had been bio-organically enhanced during her marine training. He was envious.
"It wouldn't surprise me. Fibbin's always getting banged up one way or another.
Claims he hates it. Says it's all due to innate clumsiness and a universe that has it in for him. But I've always suspected it was an affinity for trouble. Never known a Chim who went to such lengths just to get a story to tell." In a minute, he could make out the features of his friend. He shouted and raised his hand. Fibbin grinned and waved back, although his left arm was immobilized in a sling. Next to him, on a pale mare, rode a Chimmy Robert did not recognize. A messenger arrived from the cave entrance and saluted.
"Sayers, the major requests that you and Lieutenant Bolger come down just as soon as he's here."
Robert nodded.
"Please tell Major Prathachil Thorne we'll be right there."
As the horses climbed the last switchback, Lydia slipped her hand into his, and Robert felt a sudden wave of both gladness and guilt. He squeezed back and tried not to let his ambivalence show.
"Fibbin's alive," he thought. "I must get word to Athaclena. I'm sure she'll be thrilled."
Major Prathachil Thorne had a nervous habit of tugging at one ear or the other. While listening to reports from his subordinates, he would shift in his chair, occasionally leaning over to mumble into his data well, retrieving some quick dollop of information. At such times, he might seem distracted, but if the speaker stopped talking or even slowed down, the major would snap his fingers impatiently. Apparently, Prathachil Thorne had a quick mind and was able to juggle several tasks at once. However, these behaviors were very hard on some of the Chims, often making them nervous and tongue-tied. That, in turn, did not improve the Major's opinion of the Irregulars, that had only recently been under Robert's and Athaclena's command. In Fibbin's case, though, this was no problem. As long as he was kept supplied with orange juice, he kept on with his story. Even Prathachil Thorne, who usually interrupted reports with frequent questions, probing mercilessly for details,
sat silently through the tale of the disastrous Valley insurrection, Fibbon's subsequent capture, the interviews and tests by the followers of the suzerain of propriety, and the theories of Dr. Gaylett Jones. Now and then Robert glanced at the chimney Fibbon had brought with him from Port Helena. Sylvie sat to one side, between the chims Benjamin and Elsie, her posture erect and her expression composed. Occasionally, when asked to verify or elaborate on something, she answered in a quiet voice. Otherwise, her gaze remained on Fibbon, constantly. Fibbon carefully described the political situation among the Gubru as he understood it. When he came to the evening of the escape, he told of the trap that had been laid by the suzerain of cost and caution, and concluded simply by saying, "So we decided, Sylvie and I, that we'd better exit Port Helena by a different route than by sea." He shrugged. "We got out through a gap in the fence, and finally made it to a rebel outpost. So, here we are." "Right," Robert thought sardonically. Of course, Fibbon had left out any mention of his injuries and exactly how he escaped. He would no doubt fill in the details in his written report to the major, but anyone else would have to bribe the man of him. Robert saw Fibbon glance his way and wink. "I bet this is at least a 5-beer tale," Robert thought. Prathachilthorne leaned forward. "You say that you actually saw this hyperspace shunt? You know exactly where it is located?" "I was trained as a scout, Major. I know where it is. I'll include a map and a sketch of the facility in my written report."
Prathachilthorne nodded.
"If I had not already had other reports of this thing, I'd never have credited this story. As it is, though, I am forced to believe you. You say this facility is expensive, even by Gubru standards?"
"Yes, sir. That's what Galen and I came to believe. Think about it. Humans have only been able to throw one uplift ceremony for each of their clients in all the years since contact, and both had to be held on Timbrim. That's why other clients, like the Kwaku, can get away with snubbing us. Part of the reason has been political obstruction by antagonistic clans like the Gubru and the Soro, who've been able to drag out Terran applications for status. But another reason is because we're so frightfully poor by galactic standards."
Fibbon had been learning things, obviously. Robert realized part of it must have been picked up from this Gaylett Jones person. With his heightened empathy sense, he picked up faint tremors from his friend whenever her name came up. Robert glanced at Sylvie.
Life seems to have grown complicated for Fibbon. That reminded Robert of his own situation, of course. Fibbon isn't the only one, he thought. All his life, he had wanted to learn to be more sensitive, to better understand others and his own feelings. Now he had his wish, and he hated it.
"By Darwin, Goodall, and Greenpeace," Prathachilthorne pounded the table. "Mr. Bulger, you bring your news at a most opportune time." He turned to address Lydia and Robert. "Do you know what this means, gentlemen?"
Robert began.
"A target, sir," Lydia answered succinctly.
"A target is right. This fits perfectly with that message we just received from the Council. If we can smash this shunt, preferably before the dignitaries from the Uplift Institute arrive, then we could wrap the Gubru right where it pains them most, in their wallets."
"But," Robert started to object. "You heard what our spy just told us," Prathachilthorne said. "The Gubru are hurting out there in space. They are overextended. Their leaders here on Garth are at each other's throats, and this could be the last straw. Why, we might even be able to time it so their entire triumvirate is at the same place at the same time."
Robert shook his head.
"Don't you think we ought to give it some thought, sir? I mean,
What about the offer that the suzerain of probity...
Propriety, Fibbin corrected.
Propriety, yes. What about the offer it made to Fibbin and Dr. Jones?
Pratha Chilthorne shook his head.
An obvious trap, Von Eagle. Be serious now.
I am being serious, sir. I'm no more an expert on these matters than Fibbin, and certainly less of one than Dr. Jones. And certainly I concede it may be a trap, but on the surface at least it sounds like a terrific deal for Earth. A deal I don't think we can pass up without at least reporting this back to the Council.
There isn't time, Pratha Chilthorne said, shaking his head. My orders are to operate at my own discretion, and if appropriate, to act before the galactic dignitaries arrive.
Robert felt a growing desperation.
Then at least let's consult with Athaclena. She's the daughter of a diplomat. She might be able to see some ramifications. We don't.
Pratha Chilthorne's frown spoke volumes.
If there's time, of course I'll be happy to solicit the young Tim Brimmy's opinion.
But it was clear that even mentioning the idea had brought Robert down a peg in the man's eyes. Pratha Chilthorne slapped the table.
Right now, I think we had better have a staff meeting of commissioned officers and discuss potential tactics against this hyper-shunt installation.
He turned and nodded to the Chims.
That will be all for now, Fibbin. Thank you very much for your courageous and timely action. That goes the same to you, too, miss.
He nodded at Sylvie.
I look forward to seeing your written reports.
Elsie and Benjamin stood up and held the door. As mere brevet officers, they were excluded from Pratha Chilthorne's inner staff. Fibbin rose and moved more slowly, aided by Sylvie. Robert hurriedly spoke in a low voice to Pratha Chilthorne.
Sir, I'm sure it only slipped your mind, but Fibbin holds a full commission in the Colonial Defense Forces. If he's excluded, it might not go down well, politically.
Pratha Chilthorne blinked. His expression barely flickered, though Robert knew he had once again failed to score points.
Yes, of course, the Major said evenly. Please tell Lieutenant Bolger he is welcome to stay if he's not too tired.
With that, he turned back to his data well and started calling up files. Robert could feel Lydia's eyes on him.
You may despair of my ever learning tact, he thought, as he hurried to the door and caught Fibbin's arm just as he was leaving. His friend grinned at him.
I guess it's grown-up time again here, Fibbin said sotto voce, glancing in Pratha Chilthorne's direction.
It's worse than even that, old chim. I just got you tapped as an honorary adult.
If looks could name, Robert mused on seeing Fibbin's sour expression.
And you thought it was Miller time, didn't you?
They had argued before about the possible historical origins of that expression. Fibbin squeezed Sylvie's shoulder and hobbled back into the room. She watched him for a moment, then turned and followed Elsie down the hall. Benjamin, however, lingered for a moment. He had caught Robert's gesture, bidding him to stay. Robert slipped a small disc into the chim's palm. He dared not say anything aloud, but with his left hand he made a simple sign.
Auntie, he said in hand talk.
Benjamin nodded quickly and walked away.
Pratha Chilthorne and Lydia were already deep into the arcana of battle planning as Robert returned to the table.
The Major turned to Robert.
I'm afraid there just won't be time to use enhanced bacteriological effects, as ingenious as your idea was on its own merits.
The words washed past unnoted. Robert sat down, thinking only that he had just committed his first felony. By secretly recording the meeting, including Fibbin's lengthy report, he had violated procedure. By giving the pellet to Benjamin, he had broken protocol. And by ordering the Chim to deliver the recording to an alien, he had, by some lights, just committed treason.
Chapter 71 Max
A large neo-chimpanzee shambled into the vast underground chamber, hands cuffed together, drawn along at the end of a stout chain. He remained aloof from his guards, Chims wearing the invader's livery, who pulled at the other end of his leash. But occasionally he did glare defiantly at the alien technicians watching from catwalks overhead. His face had not been unblemished to start with, but now fresh patterns of pink scar tissue lay livid and open, exposed by patches of missing fur. The wounds were healing, but they would never be pretty.
"Come on, Reb," one of the Chim guards said as he pushed the prisoner forward. "Bird wants to ask you some questions."
Max ignored the probie as best he could, as he was led over to a raised area near the center of the huge chamber. There several Kwaku waited, standing upon an elevated instrument platform. Max kept his eyes level on the apparent leader, and his bow was shallow, just low enough to force the avian to give one in return. Next to the Kwaku stood three more of the Quislings. Two were well-dressed Chims who had made tidy profits providing construction equipment and workers to the Gubru. It was rumored that some of the deals had been at the expense of their missing human business partners. Other stories implied approval and direct connivance by men interned on Silmar and the other islands. Max didn't know which version he wanted to believe. The third Chim on the platform was the commander of the Probie Auxiliary Force, the tall, haughty Chen called Iron Grip. Max also knew the proper protocol for greeting traitors. He grinned, exposing his large canines to view, and spat at their feet. With a shout, the probies yanked at his chain, sending him stumbling. They lifted their truncheons, but a quick chirp from the lead Kwaku stopped them in mid-blow. They stepped back, bowing.
"You are sure, certain, that this one, this individual, is the one we have been looking for?"
the feathered officer asked Iron Grip. The Chim nodded.
"This one was found wounded near the site where Gala Jones and Fibbon Bulger were captured. He was seen in their company before the uprising, and was known to be one of her family's retainers for many years before that. I have prepared an analysis showing how this contact with these individuals makes him appropriate for close attention."
The Kwaku nodded.
"You have been most resourceful," he told Iron Grip. "You shall be rewarded, compensated, with high status, although one of the candidates of the suzerain of propriety has escaped our net somehow. We are now in a good position to choose, select his replacement. You will be informed."
Max had lived under Gubru rule long enough to recognize that these were bureaucrats, followers of the suzerain of cost and caution. Though what they wanted from him, what use he could be to them in their internal struggles, he had no idea. Why had he been brought here, deep in the bowels of the Handmade Mountain, across the bay from Port Helena? There sat an intimidating honeycomb of machinery and humming power supplies. During the long ride down the autolift, Max had felt his hair stand out with static electricity as the Gubru and their clients tested titanic devices. The Kwaku functionary turned to regard him with one eye.
"You will serve two functions," it told Max. "Two purposes now. You will give us information, data about your former employer, information of use to us, and you will help assist us in an experiment."
Again, Max grinned.
"I won't do neither, and I don't even care if it is disrespectful. You can go put on a clown suit and ride a tricycle for all I'll tell you."
The Kwaku blinked once, twice, as it listened to a computer translation for verification. It chirped an exchange with its associates, then turned back to face him.
"You misunderstand. Mistake our meaning. There will be no questions. You need not speak. Your cooperation is not necessary."
The complacent assuredness of the statement sounded dire. Max shivered under a sudden premonition. Back when he had first been captured, the enemy had tried to get information out of him. He had steeled himself to resist with all his might, but it really rocked him when all they seemed to be interested in were Garthlings. That's what they asked him about again and again.
"Where are the presentients?" they had inquired.
Garthlings? It had been easy to mislead them, to lie in spite of all the drugs and psi machines, because the enemy's basic assumptions had been so cockeyed dumb. Imagine Galactics falling for a bunch of children's tales. He had had a field day and learned many tricks to fool the questioners. For instance, he struggled hard not to admit that Garthlings existed. For a while, that seemed to convince them all the more that the trail was hot. At last, they gave up and left him alone. Perhaps they finally figured out how they'd been duped. Anyway, after that, he was assigned to a work detail at one of the construction sites, and Max thought they'd forgotten about him. Apparently not, he now knew. Anyway, the Kwaku's words disturbed him.
What do you mean you won't be asking questions?
This time it was the probationer leader who replied. Iron Grip stroked his mustache with relish.
It means you're going to have everything you know squeezed out of you. All this machinery, he waved around him, will be focused on just little old you. Your answers will come out, but you won't.
Max inhaled sharply and felt his heart beat faster. What kept him steady was one firm resolve. He wasn't going to give these traitors the satisfaction of finding him tongue-tied. He concentrated to form words.
That's against the rules of war.
Iron Grip shrugged. He left it to the Kwaku bureaucrat to explain.
The rules protect, provide for species and worlds far more than individuals. And anyway, none of those you see here are followers of priests.
So, Max realized, I'm in the hold of fanatics. Mentally, he said farewell to the Chens and Chimmies and kids of his group family, especially his senior group wife, whom he now knew he would never see again. Also mentally, he bent over and kissed his own posterior goodbye.
You made two mistakes, he told his captors. The first was letting it slip that Galad is alive, and that Fibbon made a fool of you again. Knowing that makes up for anything you can do to me.
Iron Grip growled.
Enjoy your brief pleasure. You're still going to be a big help in bringing your ex-employer down a few pegs.
Maybe, Max nodded.
But your second mistake was leaving me attached to this.
He had been letting his arms go slack. Now he brought them back with a savage jerk and pulled the chain with all his might. It yanked two of the Proby guards off their feet before the links flew out of their hands. Max planted his feet and snapped the heavy chain like a whip. His escorts dove for cover, but not all of them made it in time. One of the Chim contractors had his skull laid open by a glancing blow. Another stumbled in his desperation to get away, and knocked down all three Kwaku like bowling pins. Max shouted with joy. He whirled his makeshift weapon until everyone was either toppled or out of reach. Then he worked the arc sideways, changing the axis of rotation. When he let go, the chain flew upwards at an angle and wrapped itself around the guardrail of the catwalk overhead. Shimmying up the heavy links was the easy part. They were too stunned to react in time to stop him. But at the top, he had to waste precious seconds unwrapping the chain. Since it was attached to his handcuffs, he'd have to take it along. Along where? He wondered, as he got the links gathered. Max spun about when he glimpsed white feathers over to his right, so he ran the other way and scurried up a flight of stairs to reach the next level. Of course, escape was an absurd notion. He had only two short-term objectives, doing as much harm as possible, and then ending his own life before he could be forced against his will to betray Galen. The former goal he accomplished as he ran, flailing the tip of the chain against every knob, tube, or delicate-looking instrument within reach. Some bits of equipment were tougher than they looked, but others smashed and tinkled nicely. Trays of tools went over the edge, toppling onto those below. He kept a watch out, though, for other options. If no ready implement or weapon presented itself before the time came, he ought to try to get high enough for a good leap over the railing to do the trick. A Gubru technician and two Kwaku aides appeared around a corner, immersed in technical discussions in their own chirping dialect. When they looked up, Max hollered and swung his chain. One Kwaku gained a new apterium as feathers flew. During the backstroke, Max yelled, "Boo!" at the staring Gubru, who erupted in a squawk of dismay, leaving a cloud of down in its wake. "With respect," Max added, addressing the departing avian's backside. One never knew if cameras were recording an event. Galet had told him it was okay to kill birds just so long as he was polite about it. Alarms and sirens were going off on all sides. Max pushed a Kwaku over, vaulted another, and swept up a new flight of steps. One level up, he found a target just too tempting to pass by. A large cart carrying about a ton of delicate photonics parts lay abandoned, very near the edge of a loading platform. There was no guardrail to the lifter shaft. Max ignored all the shouts and noise that approached from every side and put his shoulder to the back end. "Move," he grunted, and the wheeled wagon started forward.
"Hey, he's over this way,"
he heard some chim cry out. Max strained harder, wishing his wounds had not weakened him so. The cart started rolling.
"You, Reb, stop that!"
There were footsteps. Too late, he knew, to prevent inertia from doing its work. The wagon and its load toppled over the edge. Now to follow it, Max thought. But as the command went to his legs, they spasmed suddenly. He recognized the agonizing effects of a neural stunning. Recoil spun him about in time to see the gun held by the chim called Iron Grip. Max's hands clenched spastically, as if the probie's throat were within reach. Desperately, he willed himself to fall backward into the shaft.
Success!
Max felt victory as he plummeted past the landing. The tingling numbness would not last long.
"Now we're even, Fibbin," he thought.
But it wasn't the end, after all. Max distantly felt his nerve-numbed arms half-yanked out of their sockets as he came up suddenly short. The cuffs around his wrists had torn bleeding rents, and the taut chain led upward past the end of the landing. Through the metal mesh of the platform, Max could see Iron Grip straining, holding on with all his might. Slowly, the probie looked down at him and smiled. Max sighed in resignation and closed his eyes.